Most people have largely forgotten about the hysteria surrounding the Y2K bug. And rightly so. I mean, it was fundamentally silly to be concerned. I'm not saying that it was outside of the realm of possibility that a few systems would crash or that it wouldn't be possible of automated billing issues, but an embarrassingly high percentage of the population believed, like my father, that it could cause a nuclear holocaust. We'd been fighting about it since Thanksgiving. That's not how missiles work, Dad. Oh, so you're a nuclear technician now. All of the control systems that launch our ICBMs are computerized, and they're old computers. They're not compliant. You don't know what will happen. I know missiles don't launch unless they're told to. It's not like they're sitting around in their silos going, oh, can I launch yet? Can I launch yet? Huh? How about now? And the computers are sitting there going, no, wait, what year is it? 1900? Crap, I haven't been invented yet. Release the dogs of war. I've been fighting with my parents for weeks, so let me go to the Drew DeLuca New Year's Eve party. But in addition to the imminent threat of thermonuclear war, they thought 15 was too young to stay out all night at a co-ed party. Originally, they had wanted to pick me up at 10. After I brought Alina home, my dad suddenly reversed his position. I could stay over at Drew's. In the past, I had always been at home when the ball dropped. Usually my brother would fall asleep around 11, and my parents had long since outgrown the compulsion to make New Year's Eve special. This usually left me alone with Dick Clark and my daydreams of having someone to kiss at midnight. Of course, that was all immaterial. There was no way Alina would turn up at DeLuca's. And after finding out what had happened to Carrie and having to tell my parents about it, well, I didn't exactly feel like celebrating either. My dad actually stayed up with me that year. He was convinced the power would go out at midnight. Part of me hoped that he was right. Sure, it might have meant the end of the world, but at least it would have taken my mind off of how crappy I felt. At midnight, the ball dropped. So many things had happened to me that year. So many things that I thought would make me feel happy, maybe just fulfilled. But the girl I loved was still miserable. That of my best friends had brain damage, and there was nothing I could do for either one of them. The world had been the same miserable place it had been that morning. No more, no less. I tried calling Alina before I went to sleep, but I hung up when her dad answered. The next day we spoke only briefly. She seemed more distant than ever, but assured me it was only because her parents were in the next room. At my parents' insistence, Mrs. Peterson joined us for a late dinner on our way back from the hospital. The dark wood surface of our dining room table was polished to a mirrored surface, and Mrs. Peterson looked out of place sitting at her old t-shirt and stained khaki work pants reflecting back up at her. My little brother was visibly uncomfortable to be sitting across from her. He had the same expression on his face that he had the first time we had gone to a Sox game by ourselves, and a homeless person had sat next to us on the tee. None of us spoke much, but before leaving, Mrs. Peterson did accept the name of a speech therapist my dad had tracked down from one of the partners at his firm earlier that day, and agreed to let us help her pay for it. I knew he had ulterior motives, but I got the impression from the look in my dad's eyes that he did really want to help. My dad's a bit of a shark, and I think that may have been the first time I'd ever seen him look at someone with pity. Monday morning, I saw Fletch for the first time since Carrie had fallen through the ice. It had been only a week, but it felt like a lifetime. Fletch looked tired in a way that you don't often see in teenagers. He looked like my grandfather right before he decided that he couldn't take any more chemo. He looked beaten. If he didn't know already, I didn't think that he could handle any update on Carrie's condition. We rode in silence. School was torture. Everyone was laughing and smiling. They complained about being back from break, but eagerly catching up with friends, swapping stories about New Year's Eve and Christmas, and commiserating about the lack of fresh powder anywhere on the East Coast that year. They had no idea Scary Carrie was lying in a hospital bed, practically unable to speak. At least when Rob had killed himself, his death had been public. We all went through it together. With Carrie, aside from Kim Murray and Dan Bergen, Fletch and I were the only ones who seemed to notice she was missing. It's lonely being miserable in a crowd of happy people. Drew teased me about having missed his party, but quickly realized I wasn't in the mood.
Hey, all right, dude?
Not even close.
Hey, you want to talk about it?
Shaking my head was all I could do without crying. Drew squeezed my shoulders in a half hug, then gave me some space by turning his back to our group of friends. I disappeared wordlessly into the crowd halfway in search of the only person that could make me feel better. I found Alina right before the bell rang for first period. She was sitting against the locker with Sarah Cohen. I couldn't hear what they were saying, but based off how quickly they stopped talking, I got the impression it was about me. All I wanted to do was put my arm around Alina, to melt against her and bury my face into her shoulder, to lose myself, even if it was for a second, in the sensation of holding her. But the bell rang before I could even get a word out, and Sarah dragged her off to class, with scarcely a backward glance. The rest of the day crawled by in a meaningless cacophony of lecturing teachers and jabbering students, which each passing minute I felt like it was harder and harder to breathe. I spent the last period staring at the second hand of the clock, willing it to move faster until it struck 3. That's when I heard them. The bells. 1. I was in my den. I was inside. Alina. 2. Writhing against her, I felt as though I'd melt and explode at the same time. 3. I never wanted the chimes to end. But they did. I was sitting in my desk, breathing hard. Everyone else around me was packing up their bags, and I took a moment to collect myself and follow suit. They'd sounded as loud as they had from the shores of Quabbin, as loud and as beautiful. That Wednesday, Fletch and I were in a car accident. He was on the way to school. We were running a little late for some reason, although I don't recall why. Fletch had slowed down the car to make the turn on the Cold Spring Road and then froze, letting the car drift into the trees on the other side of the road. For my part, I was yelling, but he didn't seem to notice for a full 8 seconds. He just sat there, his foot lightly pressing the gas, his car pressed up against a grove of small pine trees, its wheels spinning up dirt and fallen needles. I didn't need to ask what happened. It was 8 o'clock. He heard the bells. When he snapped out of it, Fletch was visibly shaken. Oh God! Oh God! I'm sorry! Are you alright? I was fine. The only real damage was a crack in the front bumper and a spent sabling. We'd been lucky. If we had just been a few seconds earlier or later, it would have struck 8 while Fletch was doing 30 or 40 down our winding street. And trees would have been a lot less forgiving. Have you heard them? Since we were out there? Yeah, twice. Carrie's heard them too. I've heard them 8 times. They keep getting louder. Fletch shuddered. Do you think this is what happened to Rob? The bells just keep ringing. Keep getting louder and louder until he couldn't take it anymore. I didn't. The bells were beautiful, or so I thought at the time. I was actually a little jealous Fletch had heard them more times than I had. We arrived after first period had already started, too late for me to have any chance of seeing Alina that day. I hadn't even seen her all week, and every time I called her house, it seemed like her father answered, and I just missed her. Awfully social for someone who'd still ate all her lunches with the guidance counselor. Although in fairness, Alina, I got it. I found the general din of the classroom intolerable, and the cafeteria even worse. Everyone else seemed so happy, so carefree. I'm not sure when exactly I began checking the time compulsively. It must have been the day Fletch went off onto the road. It might have been later that week. Regardless, the time seemed to be the only thing that I could focus on at school. Suddenly I was holding my breath, whenever an hour approached, every time hoping that I would hear the bells again. I remember thinking that it was funny. Back before I knew for sure there was something lying beyond the realm of our senses, I'd always turn to prayer. And now, after years of seeking out the supernatural as a way of bolstering my faith, after having found the evidence that I was searching for, I found myself unable to complete so much as a simple Hail Mary without my thoughts straying to the sublime beauty of the bells. I guess it was foolish of me to think that finding the widower's clock would reaffirm my Catholic faith. I still didn't know if there was a God. All I know for sure is that there were bells. And the bells were housed in a spire in the woods on an island in a reservoir just a car ride away, and I'd be getting my driver's license in a little over a week. I tried to dispel the thoughts of returning to Quabbin, but the unhappier I was at school, the more I longed to return. There was no question. Alina was avoiding me. I kept trying to call her and kept getting her parents. I didn't want them to think I was a pest, so I tried to keep my calls down to one a day. But it was so hard. I took to calling and hanging up if she didn't answer. It's pathetic, I know, but I couldn't help myself. We were taught in Sunday school that hell's worst torture is how exquisitely your soul feels the absence of God. If that's true, surely a teenager's worst torture is how exquisitely they feel the absence of their first love, especially when it's a rejection. The dirty looks started on Tuesday, the 11th, just over a week after we'd come back from break. I'd gone looking for Alina in the junior's hallway, same as I had every morning, and there was Sarah Cohen, looking at me like I was filth incarnate. It stopped me dead in my tracks. I didn't know Sarah very well, but she always seemed so friendly. Seeing that disgust directed at me, it was shocking. I wasn't really popular, but I had never elicited that sort of reaction, mostly at school, away from my handful of friends that I was invisible for. I wasn't really that popular, but I had never elicited that sort of reaction. Mostly at school, away from my handful of friends, I was invisible. Next day at lunch, I noticed it wasn't just Sarah. When I went up to get my food, I noticed the whole table of sporty girls that Alina used to sit with before Rob's suicide, were staring at me. It was the sort of reaction I'd seen people have to Scary Carrie, like they simply didn't want me to be there. While I didn't know any of these girls especially well, I had met one or two of them through Christy and thought that we were on good terms. I tried giving them a smile, tilted my head back, and that hey, and a gesture, and some of them turned away quickly. A few of the others pursed their lips in an expression I couldn't read. After that, I noticed that she kept looking over at me throughout the rest of the lunch period. I picked at my tray for a while, then I left without eating. I missed feeling invisible. I tried calling Alina again that night. I knew I wouldn't like hearing whatever it was that she had to say, but I had to hear it. Her answering machine picked up. I thought about leaving a message, but I didn't see the point. How could she treat me like this? All I ever wanted to do was help her and make her feel good, and I felt like someone had scooped out my inside and left me as a languid husk. I couldn't imagine feeling worse. I couldn't sleep. I stared up at the ceiling and tried to convince myself that she really did care about me, that her happiness, that we were together and we had made love, and that had brought her survivor guilt rushing back. Christ, I was practically praying the girl I loved was suffering from psychological problems. I don't remember if there was 3 or 4 in the morning when I heard them. Those fucking bells. They sounded so sweet and so clear. I felt like I had after the first time I kissed Alina. I saw the version of us from my daydreams walking in the halls, holding hands, smiling and laughing as we argued about whose friends to sit with that day. I felt full again. Next thing I knew, I was waking up. Thursday the 13th was a snow day. As desperately as I wanted to see Alina again, even just to bump into her, it was a relief not to be at school. I stayed in bed until nearly noon and then had breakfast with my brother. It was so calm and peaceful. Nothing to do but play video games and watch the snow fall. Maybe I'm romanticizing it now, but January 13th, 2000 was the last normal day of my life. Friday was my birthday, 16 years old. It should have been one of the happiest days of my life, but all I really felt was resolve. I decided I had to know what was going on. Enough is enough. If I couldn't catch Alina at school or get her on the phone, then I'd just have to make Alina's house the first stop as a licensed driver. Fletch and I got to school early. Ever since the bells made him drift off the road, he insisted that we leave early enough to be sure that we had parked before 8 o'clock. I skipped my locker and I went straight for the junior's hallway. Halfway there, Drew DeLuca intercepted me and pulled me into an empty classroom. Drew was co-captain of our swim team, and the years spent swimming laps had left him absolutely ripped. He moved me about as easily as he would have a small child, and when the door shut behind us, he didn't loosen his grip. "Dude, what's going on with you and Alina?" There was something very accusatory in his voice. I tried to step back, but he yanked me forward, maintaining his uncomfortably close distance. That's what I want to know, I mumbled. Drew stared unblinkingly into my eyes, like he was trying to see right through me, as I told him about how Alina came to me at his birthday party asking me about a reference in Rob's suicide note. About how we kissed at her house. About how Carrie had fallen through the ice. About how I and Ilena made love. I left out the part about the bells. Oh, Jesus fucking Christ. Drew dropped his hand from my arm and turned to walk away. The angry edge was gone from his voice, and he didn't sound relieved. Dude, Sarah Cohen told the whole swim team this morning that you are... that you're, like, stalking Ilena, saying you're like Rob Keenan. Well, actually, she implied that you were a hell of a lot worse. I sat down. It felt like the room was spinning, like the wind had been knocked out of me. You have to back off, dude. He continued. She's got a boyfriend. She has a... Who? The guy she dated last summer? What's his name? From Bishop Gorton. What's his name was Ryan Dorhurst. They'd met at a track meet 2 years ago. Ryan Dorhurst was rich. Ryan Dorhurst was tall. Ryan Dorhurst was handsome, and although I may not have been the most objective source on this, Ryan Dorhurst was a douchebag. The first time I'd ever spoken to him, I was wearing a Radiohead shirt, and he quizzed me about their album titles, as if I was some bandwagon follower who had to justify my fandom to him. How could Ilena do this to me? Take my virginity, then backslide with an old boyfriend? How could she be so shallow? Ryan Dorhurst? Happy birthday to me. I would have liked to have stayed hidden in that empty classroom, but the bell rang. Emerging into the crowded hallway, I could feel people staring at me. Whispered conversations halted at my approach. John Landry, who was on the track team with Ilena, shouldered me as I came out of the stairwell near the gym's locker room. It's weird how quickly gossip can change your whole world. I wouldn't exactly call John Landry a friend of mine, but we had sat next to each other in bio the year before, and he'd always gotten along well enough. Robert Keenan had learned, through no fault of his own, what a rumor can do to your life. And so had Ilena, which made her doing it to me somehow extra powerful. She knew how much the whispers and sidelong glances could hurt, and she was subjecting me to it anyway. Of course, in fairness to her, what she said about me wasn't a lie. Not exactly. If only she had talked to me, I wouldn't have had to go to her house that day. My mom picked me up from school a little earlier and took me to the DMV. I passed the written exam and the driving test with flying colors. She offered to let me drive home, but I declined. It would turn 4 while we were still on the road, and I didn't want to risk an accident. If my mom thought that it was weird, she didn't say anything. After we got home, I lied. I said I wanted my first car ride to be a visit to Scary Carrie, who had been released from the hospital the week before. My parents thought that was sweet. Even complimented me on what a good person I was. I thanked them and forced a smile even though I felt dead inside. I headed out for Ilena's around 4:45. Her parents wouldn't be home for another hour or two. Swear to God, all I wanted was to talk to her. I never meant for anything else to happen. Please believe me when I say that. Please. When I arrived, there was a car parked beside Elena's blue Beetle that I didn't recognize. I went up to the door, but something stopped me from ringing the bell. It was a queasy feeling, the sort of feeling you get whenever you know your life's not going to be the way that you want it to. I took a closer look at the car. It had Bishop Gutrin's parking pass. Son of a bitch was there. I walked through the yard around the back of the house. A part of me wanted to catch them red-handed, though it's not clear to me there was anything to catch. If they were together, I couldn't exactly call it cheating, because if Ilena wouldn't talk to me, clearly we weren't going out. I guess I just wanted to see it with my own eyes. I crouched down beside one of the basement windows, and I peered in, and there she was. There she was, on the couch where we'd had our first kiss, lying on top of Ryan Dorsett. His hands were inside her shirt, and hers were working aggressively to undo his belt. I wanted to leave. I wanted to run away, to scrunch my eyes closed and pretend that I had never seen anything, but I couldn't. I was held in place by a morbid fascination. It was almost like in a dream, when you're not in control and you just watch yourself from the outside. My mind was screaming to go, but my feet stayed planted and my eyes drank in every detail to this day. I remember what I saw from the window even better than I remember our first kiss. Or the way Ileana always smelled like vanilla, or how it felt when I gave her my virginity. What I saw was Ileana unfastening Dorset's pants and sliding her hand into his fly. It was tough to see her face, but I could tell she wasn't crying. I could tell she didn't feel conflicted about what she was doing. But at the time, standing there outside of her basement window, I wasn't thinking about Ileana's perspective. I didn't consider how she felt about Ryan Dorset or what she might have thought of me. I only could stare as they wriggled out of their clothes and watched as Ileana guided Dorset. I felt like Adolf Reifler. That's when it turned 5, and I lost myself completely to the bells. 1. I felt warm, but not like before. This was different. It wasn't like a blanket, it was like a fire. 2. My heart pounded in my chest like thunder in a storm. 3. I was actually aware of my body, my arms and legs pumping like pistons, the wind blowing past my face. 4. I could feel the weight of something solid in my hand. 5. Once, when I was 11, I had gotten into a fight at school, and it took 2 teachers to pry me off the other boy. I had given him a black eye and knocked out the last of his baby teeth. Anger can also feel good. Bloodlust can also feel like home. When the last of the bells tolled, they were replaced by the sound of a car alarm. Ileana, only half-dressed, was screaming and crying and sobbing. All at the same time, I looked up just in time to see Ryan Dorset, wearing nothing but boxers and a pair of sneakers, punch me in the face. I fell down hard into the pavement of Ileana's driveway, which was covered in broken glass, and apparently I had smashed his car windows with a large rock. Dorset grabbed me by my jacket and pulled me up into a seated position so that he can get a good grip on my throat. "Stop it! Stop it!" Elisa shrieked. I'm sure somewhere, one of the neighbors was already calling the cops. "What the fuck's the matter with you, huh? Why can't you just leave her alone?" Dorset asked. He maneuvered his body weight on top of mine, pinning me down and his fingers dug into my neck. It's an awful feeling, having someone you don't want to be on top of you. Pressing down. The rock was still in my hand, and I swung it with everything I was worth. It hit the side of his face with a sickening crunch. I had broken Ryan Dorset's jaw and sent him rolling into the Aminev snow-covered front lawn. He must have been in shock because it took him a second to realize how hard he'd been hit, and for the pain to set in. I could see the realization, the fear in his face. It made me feel good. It made me feel big. Dorset slowly began to crawl away on his hands and knees. I got to my feet and I held the rock up high above his head. "Please, please," Ileana whispered. All the color had drained from her face. Every bit of her was trembling. Tears rolled unchecked down her cheeks. She was looking at me, and what she saw scared her.
I'm so sorry.
I looked back at her. Her eyes were red from crying, her lips quivered. She looked a lot older than 17. And suddenly the rock felt heavy, and I didn't feel so big. I let the rock fall from my hand. It landed in the snow with a soft plop. Ryan began to blubber in pain. His words were unintangible, or maybe I just don't want to remember what he said. Blood was gushing from his mouth. It stained the snow beneath him as he crawled. I had no intention for things to turn out the way they did. Ileana was terrified of me, and that was the last thing I ever wanted her to feel. Especially about me. I opened my mouth and I found no words. I reached out toward her, desperate to comfort her, and she recoiled from me with a gasp. Her eyes squinted shut, bracing for an impact I could hardly blame her for fearing. I didn't know what else to do. So I just left. It was the last time that I ever saw Ileana Aminev. I found myself on the highway with the music blaring. I was driving fast down 495. It had to have been at least an hour and a half since I left Alina's. I had no memory of the intervening time. I couldn't go home I'd be arrested. This wasn't like a shoving match. Ryan Dorsett would need medical attention. He was the second person in less than a month that I'd have put into the hospital, and then again, oh, what was I gonna do? Make a run for Canada? Even if the police wouldn't soon be looking for my mom's car, I probably have $7 or $8 on me, and access to another 250 or so in my Baybank savings account. Hardly enough to get too far. I felt dead inside. There was only one thing that could make me feel better, and I wanted to hear them again. One last time. For real. I was going to Quabbin. The sun sets early in the winter. Hell, it had already started going down even before I had arrived at Alina's. By the time I'd hit the Quabbin, it was nearly 8:30 and dark. I parked the car near the trailer park as Fletch had done the night Carrie fell through the ice. I remember wondering how close I was to where he'd parked the night Rob found the spire. The walk to the lake took a little longer than last time. There was about 4 or 5 inches of snow on the ground, and the plows had turned the sides of the road into little snowbanks a foot or so high. It made walking on the side of the road slow going. Luckily, I only saw one car drive by, and they didn't pay me any attention. It was bitter cold. I hadn't noticed at first, but with each step, the wind was cutting further and further through that dead feel. I just kept walking. It was like being back on the hike with Scary Carrie. You're hyper-aware of your body and all of its aches and pains, but if you just kept walking, your brain goes blank. It felt good not to think. I was only about halfway between the entrance to the Quabbin and the reservoir when I heard them. So sweet and so lovely. And so warm. Suddenly I wasn't so cold anymore. I didn't feel the wind, or at least not a winter wind. I felt a warm breeze on my cheek. It smelled dewy and sweet. The full moon shone down on the lush green forest surrounding either side of the dirt road. That had been paved only moments ago. I could hear crickets. A tiny light flittered past the corner of my eye, then another and another. Fireflies dancing through the air. It was so warm. I took off my jacket and stood watching the fireflies try to find another in the hopes of mating. Then the bells finished, and I was standing in the snow, holding my jacket, staring at nothing. I quickly struggled to get back into my jacket. I looked back the way I came. The moonlight bounced off the snow, bathing everything in a weak blue light. It was beautiful, but sterile. A much harsher environment than the one in the vision that I had just had. I had returned to hear the bells one last time, but looking back in the direction of the trailer park, well, there was nothing for me back there, nothing good at any rate, so I turned back towards the reservoir and I started walking, one foot in front of the other, just me, and one last mile. When I finally reached the shore, it was nearly 9:30. The wind had blown the snow into little drifts, leaving patches of ice bare. In the moonlight, it looked almost like the Quabbin was made of white and blue marble. It was scenic, but barely noticeable. I was walking off at the larger of the two islands. Its trees, frosted by snow, left it almost invisible against the horizon. I wondered dimly if the bag with Christie's raft and my mother's Bible was lying somewhere out there on the ice. It had been cold the last couple of weeks, and the ice was silent. Either it had grown thicker, or the snow was dampening the sound of its cuckoo. I stepped out into the Quabbin's frozen surface. It was easiest to walk where the snow was thickest. With each step, I drew closer to the place where Carrie had fallen through the ice, sinking deeper into my self-loathing as I did. I almost wanted the ice to give out beneath me. The thought of plunging into the dark depths of the freezing waters below, of having that little warmth I possessed suck from my body and leaving me numb, physically unable to feel anything. That was enticing. I didn't want to feel. I didn't want to think. I didn't want to feel. Not like this. I barely caught a glimpse of Carrie's face as she fell through the ice, standing there trying to picture it. All I could see was Elena. and the horror I'd filled her with.
I considered for a moment stomping my feet in an effort to open up a fissure on the surface of the reservoir. But there was something else I wanted more than the anesthesia relief the cold offered. I wanted the bells. Being close to their source strengthened the memory of how they made me feel when I heard them. It was as if I was being pulled towards them by an invisible string. Actually, it was more like I was underwater, holding my breath, being sucked along by a gentle current. It felt like if I ever wanted to breathe again, I had to go where the waters wanted to take me. I had to find the spire.
Wind pushes snow around capriciously. If the snow can catch somewhere, more snow will pile up on top of it, forming little drifts like sand dunes in a desert. If there's enough wind, 8 inches of snow might result in some spots where the ground is barely covered, and others where the snow runs 2 to 3 feet deep. I didn't see anything that extreme that night on the frozen surface of the Quabbin, except for one oddly blocky little snowdrift. As I drew nearer, I could see in the moonlight a cloth strap peeking out of the snow. It was my duffel bag, the one I dropped after pulling Carrie out of the water. The bag had been soaked and left outside for weeks. It felt like a solid block of ice. It probably weighed close to 30 pounds. I doubted there was much in there that could be salvaged, maybe the raft, but my mom's Bible was almost certainly done for, and the incense and various things Carrie and I had accumulated were probably ruined, but I took it up anyway. Leaving it there, so close to the source of the bells, seemed as disrespectful to me as leaving trash behind in the pews of a church. The ice in its frozen straps cracked as I slung the bag over my shoulder and pressed on. Must have been 9:58 or 9:59 by the time I stepped off the ice and onto the shore of the large island, because I'd scarcely reached the wood line when the bells tolled 10. I found the ankle-deep snow replaced by a broad dirt road and the snow-capped trees with colonial homes, but these colonials weren't like the McMansions that dominated my neighborhood. No, even in the near darkness, I could see that these were more solidly built, and each looked different enough from the other that they could possibly have had. They could have been from the same plan. The bells rang out like thunder. I fell shaking to my knees, letting their raw power wash over me. I could feel the sound waves reverberating through my bones. I was vibrating to the frequency of the universe. It felt like staring into the true face of God. My whole body tingled. My whole being crackled with energy. I wept because it was so beautiful. I wept because I was unworthy. I wept because I could do nothing else. The call of the bells washed over me like a wave at the beach and sucked me into their undertow. I thought that I was leaving this world. I thought that my next breath would be at their source. I felt like a weary traveler, finally able to rest, and a dreamer waking from sleep all at once. Then the 10th bell sounded and I was lying in the snow. It was silent except for the wind, and I wept for a different reason. I was alone. Alone in the cold, in the world where I'd lost my place. There was no way but forward. There was nothing for me but the bells. I had no thoughts of Rob. Out there on that island, I never considered for a moment that the bells had played a role, a large role, a huge, monstrous role in his suicide. He'd heard them. He'd found them. In the end, he'd put a homemade shotgun in his mouth and he pulled the trigger. I'd like to think that if I had, I might not have pressed on. But when I'm being honest with myself, I know I would have. What's death compared to knowing? What's so great about my life that it'd be better than hearing the bells at their source? When I stood up, I realized I wasn't at the shore of the island. Couldn't even see the shore. I looked around, trying to figure out how I'd gotten so deep into the woods, and noticed there wasn't any footsteps behind me, but there was a deep track. It looked like when I fell to my knees, my body had been dragged through the snow. I should have stopped, but I didn't stop. I pressed on. The colonial houses, the broad dirt road that I had seen when the bells rang. I felt like I could still perceive where they'd been. Some of the trees, the ones nearest me, were wrong. They were too young. They didn't belong there.
The road was real, even if I couldn't see it. The houses loomed on all sides, even if I couldn't see them, even if decades earlier they'd all been moved or destroyed. It was like the present had been superimposed on the past. Everything I saw felt less substantial than what I knew had been there before. I'd seen the island's true face. It was on a road, and the road would lead me to the spire. The spire housed the bell, and no new growth forest could hide that from me. It was slow going. My feet were numb. Each time I tripped in the dark, I had to pull my hands away from my warm pockets to catch myself before I hit the frozen ground. Some snow had made it into my shoes. I was melting. But like the height where I befriended Carrie, I kept going. Even if I wanted to complain, who would I complain to? I trudged my way deeper and deeper into the woods. I might have been the first person to walk there since Rob had made his way to that spire back in late August. It's a weird feeling to be that alone. It's not privacy. It's isolation. When I stumbled into the clearing, I almost didn't see it. The spire. Everything else around me was frosted in snow, but not the spire. It was pristine. It stood twice my height, its whitewashed facade nearly invisible against the snow. The spire had a clean design, four large flat surfaces tapering up to a sharp point, the sort of wooden spire you'd expect to see topped with a cross on a Protestant church. I don't think I'd have seen it at all if it weren't surrounded by a half circle of withered, long-dead trees that looked as though they'd been rotting for ages. All my hair stood on end. This was the source. The spire in the woods. The spire in the woods housed the bells. I approached it with reverence, like how I used to approach the tabernacle after receiving communion. There was an energy in the air, an electricity. I could sense it. The spire was invisibly warping the space around it, like when you were a kid and your teacher had you sprinkle iron fillings around a magnet. Tonight there'd be no deer crossing signs, no air conditioners, no dates that didn't line up on a family tombstone, but soon there would be the bells. Right here, right in front of me. My hand trembled as I reached out towards it. My cold fingers traced their way across the spire's wooden surface as lovingly as they had on Alina's skin, and it was even more luxurious. I circled around the spire, trailing my hand along its seamless joints across its flawless paint. I found the window with its panes cracked out, and I wished that I had the skill to fix it. Then a better thought occurred to me. I could go in. I could be in the room with the bells when they sounded. I pushed my duffel bag through the window, then cautiously, gently, I poked my head in. I didn't meet any resistance, not exactly, but the energy the spire radiated built in intensity. My scalp tingled, my face felt flush, and my brain sang with excitement, as if all my neurons were firing all at once. Eagerly, I pressed my shoulder through the gap in the window. It was a tight fit, but I wriggled and squeezed my way into the darkness until I managed to get my hips through. I waited a moment for my eyes to adjust, but it was no use. Outside, I could see by the moonlight. The trees and their shadows stood out starkly against the white snow, but inside, there was nothing. I struggled to open my duffel bag. Ice had formed between the teeth of the zipper, and my fingers, still numb from the cold, had trouble gripping the slider, but eventually it opened enough for me to get my fingers in and force it the rest of the way. The flashlights were, of course, gone. The incense was completely destroyed, and my mother's Bible only fared a little better. Half of its pages had gotten wet when I tried to use the bag to pull Carrie out of the water, and were now frozen together in a block. I found my grandfather's lighter beneath the raft that I had borrowed from Christy. Lighter fluid's freezing point is absurdly low, something like negative 240 degrees Fahrenheit, so despite having been left outdoors on a frozen lake covered in snow for a month, it actually lit on a third try. The meager orange flame seemed so bright. I was on a small landing at the top of a flight of stairs. The landing was no bigger than a coffee table, and made of plain, unfinished wood that, unlike the beautiful exterior, had been badly warped by years of trapped moisture freezing and thawing inside of it. There was a hand railing in a similar condition. I was hesitant to lean against it, as I'd held the lighter out over the abyss and peered down. The stairs wrapped around the outer wall of the spire and disappeared into the darkness. In the flickering light, I could just barely make out a heavy beam stretched across the gap between the winding stairs, two floors below me. It had to be where the bells hung. It never entered into my mind that I'd find anything down there but the bells. It never occurred to me to wonder how Amy Lowell Putnam would feel about me descending into her home, into the room where her husband had threaded metal rods into her flesh while she was still very much alive. Into the bowels of the clockwork that hourly displayed her to the townspeople so her friends and neighbors could be entertained as her corpse zipped along on its track. I wish I had, but my every thought was occupied by the goddamn bells. My first few steps down the weathered stairs were slow and cautious. I'd test each step with my foot before fully shifting my weight, ready to pull myself back at the first sign of danger. They were slick, their surface covered in a fine layer of frost, and they bowed and creaked beneath me, but they held. And with each step, I grew bolder. My pace quickened. By the time I'd reached the next landing, I was coming down the stairs like a kid on Christmas morning. I felt like one too, eager to unwrap the presents waiting for me below. I started taking the stairs two at a time. The lighter's orange flame sputtered as I gained speed, threatening to blow out. A mirthful, childish giggle bubbled up from deep within me. I could just make out faintly the shape of the bells. They were right there. From the next landing, they'd be so close, I'd be able to reach out and touch the nearest of the two. I leapt down the last three steps, the lighter went out, and the landing collapsed beneath me. I fell through two pitch-black floors. My body flailed, desperate to find purchase on anything it could, but the only thing I managed to connect with was the floor. My feet hit first, and I had the queasy feeling of the wood shattering beneath me. This time, though, only one or two floorboards gave out, and I came to a stop with a sickening crack as my chest slammed into the ground. The wood floor, though bowed and weathered, didn't afford my hands any purchase, and I could feel the weight of my legs and stomach dragging the rest of me towards another fall through God knows how many more inky blackness. I kicked with all my strength, but I couldn't get my legs up high enough to climb out of the hole it created. In that moment, I can't even truly say that I felt panic. I was a cornered rat, all claws and gnashing teeth, a primal thing incapable of thought or feeling, governed by adrenaline and that basest of instincts. Survival. I curled my fingers into hooks and thrashed with everything I was worth, clawing my way to safety. The pain of it all crept into my mind slowly as the adrenaline wore away. The fall had knocked the wind out of me, and as I'd later find out, broken two of my ribs. I can't say how long I lay there on my back, struggling to pull air back into my lungs, but I can say that every breath I took felt like it was gonna rip me open from the inside. I gritted my teeth and attempted to sit up. My chest felt like it was on fire. I put my hands back behind me to push myself into a seated position, and I felt the sharpest pain of my life. I lost three fingernails. Those of my left index and middle finger and my right ring finger while pulling myself out of the hole on the floor. But what really hurt, what felt even worse than my ribs, was the 4-inch splinter that had stabbed beneath the nail of my right index finger and slid out of the other side, just above the joint. I collapsed back onto the ground. My hand trembled as I brought my finger to my mouth. I hesitated for a moment, trying to think if there was any way to avoid what I was about to do, but there wasn't. Maybe I was 4, maybe 5 stories below ground, in the woods. On an island in the middle of a frozen reservoir surrounded by more woods. Miles away from the nearest soul, no one was coming to help me. I bit down on the splinter and I pulled it back out the way that it came in. My mind screamed the profanities my lungs couldn't bear to push out, and it was just 4 slender inches, nothing compared to what Amy Lowell Putnam had endured. Though they were raw and bloody, my fingers probed the floor around where I lay, searching for the lighter. The only thing I found was one of my fingernails embedded between two floorboards. I thought about prying it out. But I couldn't imagine what good it'd do me. It's not as though I could slide it back into place. Once I was sure the lighter wasn't within arm's reach, I found myself wondering if I wanted to find it. A part of me knew I'd eventually have to if I didn't want to starve or freeze to death beneath the spire. But it hurt so much to move, and hadn't I come here to surrender myself to the bells one more time? Wasn't that what I really wanted? It was. So I sat alone in the cold and the dark, waiting for the widower's clock to strike 11. The clapper of the bells struck their surface with the force of a cannonball. In that instant, suddenly there was light. It was a soft light, but after the total darkness at the bottom of the clock tower, I found the way it glinted off the innumerable gears and tracks and coils filling the room, blinding like the glare of the winter sun bouncing off the snow. A man spoke, his voice small and distant.
"So you've heard my bells."
Adolf Reifler stood, a bent old man before his workbench. His face was wrinkled and he leaned heavily on a cane, but his eyes burned with an intensity that belied his frail voice. When he spoke again, I noticed his lips didn't move.
"You're missing what you've come so far to see."
I stood almost automatically, and was surprised to find that although I could still feel my injured ribs and see the blood trickling from my mangled fingers, I could move with relative ease. Adolf turned back to his bench.
"The stairs behind you will lead you out."
I marched across the wood floor, where the hole I had just created should have been. I was dimly aware of the same dreamy feeling I had outside of Aelin's house when I had felt compelled to watch her screw Ryan Dorset. I'm not sure if I listened to Adolf because I wanted to, although, make no mistake, I did want desperately to see the widower's clock, or because I had no choice. It felt almost as though I was watching myself as I headed towards the stairs.
"Be sure to try the Marmalkutchen,"
Adolf said.
"It's really quite good."
The stairs dumped me out into the middle of a well-appointed room. An oriental rug ran down the center, ornately framed. Paintings hung on the walls between each of the windows. It looked like quite a grand foyer. The perfect entrance to any courthouse or place of business out to impress the public. The carpet led to a huge pair of double doors, and I went to them without a second thought. They opened with ease despite their size onto a summer night at what appeared to be a party. There were maybe 2 dozen or so men and a half dozen women, all sporting old-fashioned suits and dresses, the sort of thing that they likely only wore to weddings and special occasions. They all stared up over my head, expressions of awe plastered dumbly over their frozen faces. I thought for a moment, just a moment, that they were staring at me, but quickly realized they were watching what I'd come to see. The dance of Reifler's automatons. And unbeknownst to them, his wife and her lover. I made my way through the crowd. The bells chimed for only the second time. Time seemed to have become loose, more elastic. My feet were moving at the proper speed, but each tick of the great clock dragged out for several seconds. Tick. It was nauseating. Ta. I took a spot beside a table full of refreshments. A man in a smart-looking uniform stood behind it, but like all the others, he had eyes only for the clock. Helping myself to a plate of marble cake and a heavy silver fork, I turned to finally get my first glimpse of the widower's clock in all its glory. The clock tower was illuminated by electric lights, which surprised me as I thought that Enfield wouldn't have been electrified in the early 1930s. It was easily 5, maybe 6 stories in height. Its base was almost as broad as the width of Reifler's house, and it tapered slowly until it reached the spire. Its white wood paneling gleamed in the electric light as grand and audacious as the Tower of Babel. It blasphemously penetrated the starlit sky. The second floor was dominated by the tracks, where the automatons hourly performed. Adolf Reifler, for all of his faults, was truly a masterful engineer. His creation zipped along with such grace and fluidity, it was almost impossible to believe that they weren't alive. Except for 2. A sluggish southern belle, and a stiff-limbed Confederate soldier, Ironically, the two most wooden figures on stage were the only two made of actual flesh and blood. Behind Amy Lowell and her lover as a backdrop, which must have been nearly a story in height, the Grand Plantation House, on fire, rotated slowly into view. The Union automatons, each equipped with small electric lights designed to look like torches, charged towards the plantation house. They touched their torches to cutouts painted to look like cotton fields as they went, and everywhere the torches touched, a red light turned on beneath the cutouts, illuminating the cotton flowers, revealing they were made of glass and sparkling as though they were actually on fire. As the troops reached the plantation house, another group of automatons rose to greet them. Slaves. I cringed when I saw the slave automatons. They were such racist caricatures. The slaves set about beating their former owners, much to the delight of the New England audience, who hooted and hollered as the rebels received their comeuppance. The Southern Bell and Confederate automatons crumbled beneath the attack. Their bodies folded in on themselves in a way that was only possible if their spines had been broken in multiple locations. The slaves grabbed Amy Lowell's corpse and dragged it off stage. Two of the slave automatons turned as they departed, flashing toothy grins at the spectators. Adolf Reifler was not a subtle man. The bells rang once more, just as the Union soldiers shot the prone Confederate automaton. The onlookers burst into applause. Well, most of it did. I noticed a man just off to my right hadn't celebrated. He looked bored, as though he'd seen this all before. Something else was off about him, too. He wasn't dressed like the others. He was wearing a t-shirt and jeans. I wasn't the only one who'd heard the bells. I wasn't the only one who'd found the tower. And I wasn't the only one watching the automaton's endless dance. My eyes scanned the crowd. There was an emaciated man in a park ranger's uniform, the bones of his face plainly visible beneath his skin, leaning against the end of the refreshment table. There was a boy in a tie-dyed shirt who looked to be about 13. His slashed wrists covered his corduroys in blood, but he gave his injuries no notice. Were they dead? Was I? Had the fall killed me? I noticed another figure sitting alone near the wood line, a young man with a slender build about my height. His skin burnt to a crisp with the color of charcoal, and most of his jaw was missing. Robert Edward Keenan. What was left of his skin flaked off his neck as he turned his head and fixed me with his gaze. Beneath his blackened eyelids, his watery eyes were as blue as a clear sky. Rob patted the ground next to him. The bells chimed once more, and Rob and I shuddered in bliss. I took a seat next to him. He tried to speak, but his injuries made it impossible to understand him. I think he was trying to apologize for killing himself, or maybe he was just sorry to see that I'd followed him to the bells. I don't know. We sat together in silence, watching as another glass backdrop rotated into view, a glasswork of Atlanta. The lights made it flicker as though it was on fire. Time seemed to return to full speed, and the bells finished calling out the hour. My body shivered and my ribs screamed. It was pitch black once more, and I was sitting with my back against something, a wall, maybe, and my ribs let me know in no uncertain terms that they did not appreciate this position. Slowly, I slid down until I was lying on my back. I couldn't fully process what I'd seen. In his note to Fletch, Rob said, "I will soon join them," staring at her face as she runs the endless race. Had he known he'd be stuck there when he died? Stuck watching the widower's clock, stuck watching Amy Lowell Putnam endlessly run around and around in the automaton her husband had concealed her in. Was I gonna be stuck too? All I could say for sure is that the spell was broken. I never wanted to hear the bells again. The cold had numbed my fingers to the point where I could feel little more from my missing nails than a dull ache, and while I was thankful for the small blessing, it also meant that hypothermia and frostbite couldn't be far behind. I needed to find the lighter. I needed to find a way out of there, or my questions about the afterlife would be answered all too soon. I tried pulling myself along the ground with my arms, but the stress on my ribs was too great. I had to pull myself across the ground using my legs. It was painful, but bearable. The darkness was so absolute, I had no idea which way I was facing or where the hole was in the floor. I moved slowly, dancing my fingers over the wood like an insect's antenna, hoping to find the little metal lighter that could mean the difference between life and death. I was beginning to panic. I'd searched an area maybe twice the length of my body, and I found nothing, not even the far wall. The room had to be huge. I could barely move. What if the lighter had fallen through the hole I made when I hit the floor? I was never going to find it. I began mumbling prayers to myself just to keep my growing sense of despair at bay. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb. Jesus, Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen. The Virgin Mary, the most exalted woman in all of Christianity, what could be more comforting than praying to her, the Mother of God? Wasn't I a child in despair? Don't all despairing children cry out for their mothers? So why did it feel so empty to pray to her now? I didn't know, but elected to continue my work in the oppressive silence. My fingers were so cold and numb, the lighter didn't even register when they sent it sliding deeper into the darkness. I only knew I'd found it because of the sound it made sliding across the warped planks. I flicked the flint once and nothing. Twice and it sparked. Three times and it lit. To suddenly see the flame was like staring at the sun. It took my eyes several seconds to adjust. That's when I noticed I wasn't alone. Figures stood all around me, casting long shadows across the floor that disappeared into the edge of black beyond the lighter's reach. I panicked. I couldn't run, I couldn't fight, but I scrunched up my face and I braced for an impact that never came. Slowly I reopened my eyes, and much to my relief, realized that the figures were automatons. After 60-some-odd years of neglect, they were all in a state of disrepair. Their plaster faces were spider-webbed with cracks, pieces, sometimes full limbs, laid in heaps around their bases. I was surprised I hadn't encountered any of the tracks which lay everywhere on the floor, but I suppose I hadn't covered very much area lying around on my back, nor would I be able to leave by doing so. I gritted my teeth and, despite the pain, forced myself up onto my feet. The plaster bodies of the automatons seemed small, scarcely 5 feet in height, as I picked my way slowly between them. It made Amy Lowell and her lover, having been hidden inside of these things, seem all the more grotesque. There was no way Adolf could have done it without chopping off their hands and feet. One by one, I climbed the stairs, taking frequent breaks when the pain in my ribs grew too intense for me. Eventually, I drew even with the bells, which appeared to be rusted fast to the thick iron rings from which they hung. I don't know why this surprised me so much. I guess somewhere in the back of my mind I thought they'd be made of polished silver and sparkle like starlight. In time, I reached the collapsed landing, or rather, reached where it should have been. Now there was nothing but a gap, 5 feet across, with the staircase continuing its upward climb on the far side. It would have been easy enough to jump if my ribs weren't broken, and I trusted the wood on the other side to hold my weight. But they were broken, and I was terrified of taking another fall. I sat down on the steps and cried, utterly convinced that I would die there and join Rob and Adolf and Amy Lowell in front of the widower's clock every hour on the hour for all eternity. It wasn't fair. Yes, I had chosen to investigate the spire in the woods, but I didn't choose to crave the bells. I didn't choose for them to warm me when I was cold or comfort me when I was scared. I didn't choose to black out at the sight of Aelin and Ryan Dorset, and I certainly wouldn't claim to have been in my right mind when just an hour earlier I chose hearing the bells one more time over searching for a way out. The lighter closed with a snap that echoed in the darkness. I had been Catholic my whole life, but as I sat there on the edge of the broken stairs, straining to see even the faintest sliver of moonlight from the window that laid beyond my reach, I knew that my faith was gone. I had set out to find evidence that there was more to creation than could be explained by science, and though I'd certainly found that, I felt more alone in the universe than ever. What kind of a god would create a world so cruel that it contained the belts? How could I pretend there was a design and a moral underpinning governing the universe when something as innocuous as a beautiful sound could rob you of free will and, by all indications, damn you from it? Eventually, I got so tired of staring at nothing. It was too cold to keep sitting there. I lit the Zippo and headed back down the stairs. I needed to find a way to warm up. My duffel bag was sitting a few feet from the hole that I created in the fall. I pulled out the raft and I briefly considered inflating it. It would have been nice not to have to lie directly out in the cold, hard floor, but ultimately I decided it was best to use it as a blanket. It occurred to me that there might be something useful in the floor below. I crept as close to the edge of the hole as I dared, held the lighter over the chasm and peered down. It looked like most of the room below had been claimed by groundwater that had frozen solid. If the planks that broke my ribs hadn't held, I doubt that I would have survived slamming into the ice. Lying back down hurt like hell. The raft didn't seem like it was going to do much for me, but any insulation was better than none. Reluctantly, I closed the lighter. It didn't have an unlimited supply of fuel. I'd have to be careful with it. Waiting for midnight, shivering in the dark, my mind's eye kept conjuring images of Rob Keenan's burnt face, his one good eye watering. I really didn't want to join him. At the same time, I couldn't wait to be warm again. With a deafening clang, the bells tolled. It was midnight. And I once again found myself lying on the floor of Adolf Reifler's workroom. "You're back?" He never looked at me, just continued to scan the rows of wrenches that hung from the wall. "People don't usually come back quite so soon." "I can't get out the stairs, Brooke."
"I'm sorry to hear that."
His voice was filled with pity, but his unmoving lips retained their scowl. He took a wrench from the wall and began picking his way back through the tangled mess of gears that seemed to only exist when the bells were ringing. I followed him to a hidden corner of the room where the Southern Bell and Confederate soldier automaton stood. Adolf's deft fingers pushed the dress down over the Southern Bell's shoulder, exposing a bolt on her neck. He slipped the wrench over it and set to work. From beneath the lacquered wood, Amy Lowell's bones splintered and popped. My stomach revolted at the sound, and I looked for a place to retch. Adolf continued to smile as he gave the bolt another half turn.
"You mustn't judge me too harshly,"
came his sad little words.
"You can't fathom the regret, the burden I carry with me for the rest of my life."
He pulled her dress down further, pausing only briefly to admire his handiwork as he exposed the majority of the automaton's body before continuing to the next bolt.
"I loved my wife. Despite her faults, her vanity, her frivolity, I loved her. She was mine."
His hand slid up her body, pulling her dress back into place.
"There was no pleasing her."
He lifted her arm up by the wrist and let go. Her hand herked and jerked as it fell back into place.
"Scheiß, scheiß,"
he yelled, his lips moving with each curse. He grabbed the automaton by her head and twisted it violently in a way no neck should bend. It sounded like cracking knuckles. The automaton's blank eyes seemed to stare right at me. They were such a lovely shade of brown. I was lost in those eyes and thought of Alina until Adolf's wrench returned to work and the sounds of bone crunching shook me from my revelry.
"You mustn't doubt my love for her,"
Adolf whispered through his closed lips.
"What you're seeing, I was simply angry then. It was a malady of spirit, and I admit that I have a temper, like squalls on the open sea. My foul moods disappear almost as quickly as they come. Taken against the rest of our marriage, not to mention the courtship, this was a moment, a fleeting moment. And it wasn't as though she was blameless. You can't possibly know, can't possibly understand the humiliation of seeing another man take what is rightfully yours."
I felt compelled to speak. I've always hated when someone challenged my experiences. It made me feel so small, but it was more than that. My mouth moved, but it was like I was outside my body, listening to myself tell Adolf all about Elena and what I'd done to Ryan Dorset.
"So you do understand?"
He sounded relieved, as if I'd just given him absolution for his sins. The bell tolled. Adolf gave the bolt in the automaton's elbow a full turn, splintering Amy Lowell's bones. It was loud, like a branch snapping off a tree in a storm. He again lifted her arm and let it fall. He must have been pleased with the results because he set down his wrench and headed towards the stairs. I followed without thinking. Adolf Reifler slid through the crowd, exchanging pleasantries with farmers and businessmen, neighbors and travelers alike. No one seemed to notice me follow in his wake. They never looked at me or reacted to anything Adolf and I said to one another. They also don't seem to notice any of the others that were like me. Stuck. Most of the conversations Adolf had with his guests were brief. They'd offer him some sort of enthusiastic pleasantries that I imagine you'd hear any time a work of art is unveiled. He'd respond graciously enough, until the man he addressed as Edwin inquired about Amy Lowell's whereabouts. Something in Edwin's tone made me think that he was interested in more than paying his respects.
"I haven't seen her all night," Edwin said. "Are you sure? I could have sworn she was out here around 11.
Adolf's voice dripped with condensation. The couplet Rob left in his suicide note to Elena floated around in my foremind. "And every hour I see her face, and she runs the endless race." When I'd first heard the story of the widower's clock, I had thought that it was cruel that one could be damned just for laying eyes on Amy Lowell's corpse. After all, we hadn't killed her. We didn't put her on display. What I realized watching Edwin calling it a night was that the partygoers weren't stuck watching the endless race. But they had been, they wouldn't have been able to leave. No, only those of us who had heard the bells and followed them to the spire were stuck. But why? They'd heard the bells. They'd heard the real bells. Why weren't they stuck with us? Midnight marked the end of the automaton's reenactment, or Lee's surrender to Grant. Once Lee had signed the articles of surrender, the tent backdrop zipped out of view, and dozens upon dozens of automatons took their curtain call, dancing behind the generals like something out of a Bubsy Berkeley musical. The freed slaves came out in a chorus line, doing the can-can as if they were the Rockettes. The partygoers howled with laughter. I wanted to be disgusted. It was every bit as racist as a minstrel show, but no matter how much of Adolf Reifler's cruel indifference was reflected in his work, the widower's clock was still too fine a thing to look away from it. When the Southern Bell automaton returned, I couldn't help but notice how sinuously its arm moved. Her arm. The bells tolled once more, and I was alone again, freezing in the dark. It was so cold, the blood from my fingers froze before it could clot. The raft wasn't much of a blanket. I needed to make a fire, or I was going to wind up with frostbite. Half my mother's Bible was a chunk of ice, but the top half was dry. I began ripping the undamaged portions out. The delicate work was slow going with my fingers. I twisted up the torn pages and set them in a small pile near the hole in the floor. I wasn't worried that the floorboards would catch. They'd absorb far too much moisture over the years. Besides, paper burns faster and at a fairly low temperature, especially when each page is as thin as the Bible's. After a few minutes, my hands weren't quite as numb, but it was clear my meager kindling wouldn't hold until morning. I needed more fuel if I was going to survive. My ribs weren't thrilled to be moving again. It would have been so much easier if the bells were ringing. I didn't want to love their sound, but they were like an X, just can't get over them. As bad as they are for me, even today, I still crave them. The automatons hung lifeless on their posts. Their clothes had largely disintegrated. Moisture had penetrated much of their lacquered finish, spotting them with mold. Even though the years hadn't been kind, looking at them in the flickering glow of the lighter, they were still marvelous. I ran my hand down the arm of a rebel soldier, almost as lovingly as Adolf had done with the automaton that encased his wife's remains. If I wanted to survive, I'd have to burn it. The area that had once been Adolf Reisler's workspace was littered with rusty tools and ancient gears. I took up some of the wrenches from where it had fallen. My fingers ached just holding it, and set about dismembering the nearest automaton. The bolts were rusted. It was tough to get any of them to budge. Straining against the wrench made my ribs feel like they had been replaced with broken glass and fish hooks. But eventually the bolts turned and the arm fell to the ground. The wood portion of the arm was no more than a quarter of an inch thick, just enough to cover the clockwork inside and hold the paint and finish. It wouldn't burn for much longer than the paper. I had to burn them all. The only upside was that I wouldn't have to screw another bolt. The wood was brittle enough that I could smash it to pieces with a wrench, and if I used my offhand, well, it still hurt like hell, but there wasn't anything that I could do about that. I smashed the Confederate and Union soldiers. I smashed Lee and Grant and Lincoln. I smashed women and children and slaves and then gathered up the pieces. I had already ripped apart and burnt the pages of my mother's Bible, but somehow smashing the automatons felt worse. I felt like a small child watching the tide wash away a beautiful sandcastle. There would never be another clock like this. The rack that had once held Adolf's wrenches on the wall made a decent grate, and soon I had a sputtering fire. It wasn't great, but it was warm enough that I'd live. I draped the raft over my shoulders and slowly laid myself down. I was out of immediate danger, and I could feel my body shutting down. I woke when the bells tolled one. The fire was gone. Adolf's workshop was warm, but before I could so much as sit up, their call ended and I was back where I'd begun. I threw more splinters of wood on the fire and laid back down. Sleep didn't come easy. The automaton's nude clockwork, exposed for the first time in decades, cast intricate shadows that seemed to dance in the firelight. I couldn't put my finger on it, but something was bothering me about. I awoke at 2 o'clock. It was dark inside the workroom, but when the doors opened for the slave automatons to zip out, the electric lights illuminating the clock poured in. The Southern Belle hung limp on her post. Her eyes stared blankly in my direction. A large backdrop swung out through the door blocking the light. I was alone in the dark with Amy Lowell's corpse. Once the backdrop rotated out of the light, I saw the Southern Belle slide out after it. For just a split second, I thought that I saw the Southern Belle's head swivel on her neck as if she was tracking me with her eyes, but it had to have been the clockwork getting her in position to perform, right? Then I realized what was bothering me about the automatons. Fletch had told me Rob put his fingers inside the eye sockets of a human skull, but all the automatons, before I'd smashed them up for firewood, had their lacquered faces intact. Amy Lowell's corpse returned to its starting position, its limbs swung forward like a rag doll's when it came to an abrupt stop. She was looking at me again. Could a sculpture have a ubiquitous gaze? Or was that only paintings? My heart was racing as I waited for the bells to ring a second time. Why had Adolf painted her face with such a creepy little grin? It wouldn't stop staring. I rose to my feet and I turned her head away from me. I did it quickly because I couldn't stand to touch her. The bells tolled once more. Was Amy Lowell's body going to wait for me in the dark? Amid the kindling there was only a couple pieces of wood large enough to use as a torch. It took a painfully long minute, my eyes straining to detect anything out of place in the darkness, to get one of them to catch. I held the torch aloft in my left hand, and even though I doubted in my present condition that I could ever swing it, I held one of the larger wrenches in my right. The weight of it felt good. It reminded me of the rock I had used to attack Ryan Dorset. The floorboards groaned beneath my feet, and I moved from automaton to automaton, examining each one in turn. The faces weren't designed to move. Beneath the wood of each of them, a little metal knob that could be mistaken for a skull. There was a stairwell in the far corner going down to the room below. I had twice used it while the bells were ringing, but now there were nothing down there but ice. Had Rob gone that deep? I doubted the groundwater would have been lower in the summertime, but I can't say for sure. Cautiously, I went down, one creaking step at a time. Dirt and other particulates made it impossible to see much of anything in the ice, although I thought that I could make out some of the furniture that I'd seen on my way out to view the clock. I was reluctant to venture too far into the room, lest I slip on the ice and break another bone, but I was sure there was nothing of interest to be found. My heartbeat slowed. I was relieved not to have found Amy Lowell's automaton. Rob could have touched anything in the dark. Maybe he was touching her automaton while the bells rang and found himself alone in the dark after their last toll. Or maybe Fletch got part of the story wrong. Who could say?
I can.
I crept back to my fire, wrapped the raft around me, and let my exhaustion overtake me.
My fire had burnt out while I was asleep, and I awoke shivering violently.
There was plenty of wood, but I was almost out of Bible pages. As I carefully arranged twists of paper beneath some of the thinner splinters, I heard a dreadful sound. It was quiet, but impossible to miss, like fingernails on a chalkboard. I froze. The fire could wait. The noise stopped. I held my breath and I strained my ears to listen for even the faintest sound. Nothing. Maybe an animal had gotten in here with me and scratched its claws against the metal surface. A raccoon or a rat could live down here. Maybe an owl nested in the old gears. I wouldn't exactly call myself an animal lover, but I found the idea of another living thing being nearby very comforting. I returned to the work at hand. When you're building a fire, airflow is key. If the wood presses down on the paper too much, you'll smother the flame before the wood can catch. My hands were shaking from the cold, and it was tough getting the wood to sit right, but I managed it after several tries. Just as I flicked the lighter to light the paper, the noise came again. It was a long, dry screech, the kind of sound a metal gate makes when its hinges need oil. There was no way an animal was making that noise. Desperately, I groped around the ground for a wrench, ignoring the cries of pain from my raw, still bleeding nail beds. The sound grew closer in fits and starts. I couldn't find the wrench in the dark. I could use the lighter, but it was coming from the direction of the automatons. It couldn't have been very far. 10 feet, maybe 15. I didn't want to look. I didn't want to see what could be making that noise. I gave up on the wrench and I crawled backwards, trying to get away. It drew closer. My hand found nothing but air, and I was momentarily filled with that sickening feeling of falling until my back slammed hard into the wood at the edge of the hole. With my shoulders stretched over the ledge, the strain of my ribs was unbearable. I had to bite my tongue to keep from crying out in pain. The lighter was my only chance to get around the pit. I didn't want to look. I was shaking so badly I nearly dropped the lighter, and then the noise stopped. I sat in pitch black and total silence, my heart still racing, unsure of what to do. Light my way around the hole, search in the dark for the wrench. Whatever it was didn't give me long to ponder. The small thud of something heavy hitting the wood echoed through the room, followed by a dragging sound. I flicked the lighter once, and nothing. The sound grew closer, twice, and it lit.
Standing over me was the Southern Bell automaton. The polished wood veneer was badly burnt in places.
The left half of its face was broken away, revealing the hollowed eye socket of Amy Lowell Putnam's skull. I screamed until my broken ribs forced me to stop. But what remained of Amy Lowell's wooden face just stared back at me, as blank as ever. Her head was still twisted around like I had left it at 2 o'clock. She stepped unsteadily towards me. Her limbs were stiff, her movements spastic and unnatural. It was almost as if she wasn't in complete control of her own body. The pole, which had once pulled her along the clock's tracks, making her dance, hung down from beneath her legs and dragged on the floor behind her. My eyes darted down, looking for the wrench.
She was standing right over it.
For a moment, as slow as she moved, I thought that I'd be able to outrun her, but as I stood and turned to skirt the hole, she showed me I was mistaken. Her arms sprang forward with such a force they almost knocked me to the floor. Her wooden fingers dug into my shoulders, pinching my flesh against the bone. Her face, all white, remained as impassive as a porcelain doll's. I couldn't bear her looking at me, so I dropped the lighter. We struggled there in the dark on the edge of the hole, crying and sniveling. I begged for miserable life as she forced me down to my knees. I felt the heavy metal pole that impaled her corpse brush against my legs as she continued to maneuver my body against my will. She turned me around, forcing me first to my hands and knees before finally shoving me onto my stomach. Her hands pinned my shoulders to the ground. I could feel her torso folding itself. The remains of her spine must have been bent at a right angle. The metal pole rose and fell, each time smacking the floor with a dull thunk. Her chest kept twisting like a wasp, moving its abdomen in position to sting. I didn't fully process what was happening. until the pole came down on my inner thigh. Amy Lowell Putnam intended to treat me to some of what she'd endured at her husband's hands. I stopped thinking, I stopped feeling, I was too terrified for that. I flailed my limbs, I scratched at the wood floor with my remaining fingernails. When my hand came down in the hole, I didn't even consider the consequences. It was the only way I might possibly avoid being sodomized by an automaton, and I took it. I pulled with every last ounce of strength I could muster. My ribs screamed in agony, blood started gushing from my fingers once again, but I kept pulling, dragging myself and Amy Lowell right to the very edge. The pole came down on my leg again, it felt like being hit by a hammer. When she raised the pole once more, I lifted my upper body over the edge and rolled my shoulders down. Amy Lowell's weight must have been off balance because she went spilling over the edge, landing on the ice below with a sickening crash. I was back where I'd started, lying in the pitch black, struggling for breath. From the hole came a small sound, almost a scratching noise, then a thud. Followed by more scratching, Amy Lowell was still moving. I fumbled about on my hands and knees until I found the lighter. I lit it on the third try. I held it over the hole in the floor. Amy Lowell's head had been twisted nearly 180 degrees in the fall. A chunk of her skull from just over her eye socket had been knocked out, along with much more of the Southern Belle veneer. But it hadn't slowed her spastic movements. Her wooden hands and feet struggled to gain purchase on the ice. My feet started moving. I had no clue where to go. Where could I? There was no way out. I just had to get as far away from Amy Lowell Putnam as I could. I grabbed the wrench as I passed, and I took to the stairs. The flames sputtered as I climbed. I had no idea how much lighter fluid I had left, and I found myself wishing that I had grabbed another piece of wood that I could use as a torch. I held it out, though, all the way to the topmost stair that I could reach. I sat down and quietly closed the lighter. My mistake became obvious the moment I heard the pole rise and fall on the first step of the staircase. Thump! I had nowhere to go. Thump! I was more trapped than I would have been in the wide open room below. Thump! I had to get out of here. Out of the spire. Thump! I lit the lighter once more and I held it aloft. Thump! Can I make that jump? How stable were the beams holding up the stairs? Thump! Beneath the gaps in the stairs, Amy Lowell's corpse continued its climb. Thump! There was only 5 feet, give or take, separating me from the surface. Nothing. Thump! Of course, the stairs were higher on the far side of the gap. Thump! And the wood probably couldn't support me landing on it. Thump! And if I was in no condition to jump, thump! And there was no way I could make it. I was stuck, and she was coming for me. Thump! I slumped down on the top step, and all I could think was, I don't want to die, I don't want to die, I don't want to die. Thump! Then I thought that dying might be preferable to what she had planned for me. I could just lean back and fall, splatter my brains all over the floor below. Thump! What if I didn't die? What if I only broke an arm or my leg? She'd turn around. Thump! Come get me. Thump! There was no running. If I was going to survive, I'd have to fight. I had the wrench. I had the high ground. Maybe I could get lucky and toss her over the edge, or worst case scenario, take her with me. Thump! 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 There were 18 steps between each landing. The pole hanging down from her legs prevented her from standing. She had to crawl on all fours. Her hands and feet sounded like hard-soled shoes against the wood steps. Each time she reached a landing, the pole would drag across the ground. When she reached the landing below mine, I sparked the lighter and set it against the wall, hoping that would be enough to keep it from getting knocked over in the fight to come. Amy Lowell didn't react. She just kept climbing. I stood and raised the wrench over my head. My breathing was rapid and shallow. Her head was still twisted around on her neck, staring off into the darkness. She'd stopped, just outside of my reach, still as a stone. She appeared every bit as inanimate as all the other automatons. Was she trying to lure me in? Or draw me away from the edge? Why was she just sitting there? My arm was beginning to shake. I couldn't hold the wrench up for much longer. It was now or never. Before my foot could hit the step below mine, her arms and legs uncoiled and she exploded forward. My wrench hit feebly on her back as her wooden hands latched onto my throat. Together we began falling backwards towards the gap in the stairs. Just before we slipped over the edge, the bells tolled. My back slammed against the stairs. The automaton was gone. My brain was still panicking. I couldn't think of anything but her. Where was she? Where was Amy Lowell Putnam's body? She was running the endless race. Down at the bottom of the stairs. I scrambled to my feet, determined to put more distance between us. The stairs were solid beneath me. It was a good feeling, one that we take for granted most of the time. The bells rang a second time just as I reached the slatted windows at the top of the spire. A dizzying notion bubbled out of my subconscious. If I was standing here when the bells stopped ringing, what would happen when the bells finished tolling 11? I had been shunted inside, but not back to where I had begun. Could I leave? Could it be that simple? I raised the wrench in my hand. It would make short work of thin wooden slats. But I couldn't do it. This was the spire. The real spire, and not decrepit remains. It housed the bells. The note they sang was beautiful beyond comprehension. I knew it was crazy. I knew it was my life on the line, but I couldn't destroy any part of the widower's clock. Not while the bells were ringing. You can't understand unless you had heard them ring. The vibrations penetrate you. They infuse you. They permeate you. You would do anything to hear the bells, sacrifice anything, no matter how much you'd regret it later, no matter how much they scared you or made you question your humanity. You hear their call. To hear their call is to be owned by them. Gently, I laid the wrench on the ground and I began removing the slats one at a time, carefully not to chip the paint. I felt like a fool. I knew I should have just bashed my way outside. I knew it, but I couldn't do it. Instead, I was treating the removal of each slat as if I was an artist restoring the Mona Lisa. The bells would ring again any second, and that'd be it. Maybe I'd be up here on the landing, maybe I'd be back on the stairs where I started. Maybe Amy Lowell's automaton would be with me, or maybe I'd be alone in the cold and in the dark. Finally, I removed enough slats to squeeze through into the moonlight. Clinging to the spire for dear life, I haphazarded a glance downward. The party appeared to be over, but I could still make out those poor lost souls I'd joined one day ago. Stuck watching the endless race for all eternity, and I could see some of the automatons illuminated by the harsh electric lights. Two of them moving swiftly, zipping across their tracks. The bells rang for the third time. I scrunched my eyes closed. If it hadn't worked, I didn't want to know. And I stepped off the ledge. The first thing I was aware of was the cold. Then the pain in my hands and ribs, and then I noticed the wind. I opened my eyes to see snow glistening in the moonlight, and the long shadows cast by trees. I had stepped off the spire, and I dropped only a foot or so, falling to my knees in the snow. My eyes brimmed with tears of joy. I wanted to kiss the ground and throw the snow up in the air, and wallow around in it like a pig in its own filth, but then I remembered. I recalled the way Scary Carrie had looked at the hospital. The swollen black lumps of necrotic flesh where frostbite had set in. My mother's car was a solid hour and a half walk away, and I wasn't moving as quickly as I usually did. I got walking as fast as I could bear. I heard the bells, truly heard them for the last time, near the fork where the access road joins Old Ware Enfield Road. But they didn't fill me with warmth, like they had before. No, they stopped me dead in my tracks. They tugged at my guts. They called me home, but also filled me with the sensation of being watched by eyes in the darkness. To this day, I still hear them hourly when I go off my meds. There were two police officers waiting for me when I got to my mom's car. You might think that I would have run all over again. After all, it was the fear of arrest that had sent me chasing the bells, but I didn't. Instead, I cried. It was cold. I was tired, and my whole body hurt like hell. I didn't care how much trouble I was in. I was just happy to see people, real people again, people who were alive. I learned later that the police had no idea who I was or what I had done to Ryan Dorset. They were there because I'd parked in front of the same trailer that Fletch had parked in front of back in December. When the owner had gotten up to go to work and seen my car outside, she called the police. Apparently, in his haste to get the car after Carrie had fallen through the ice, Fletch had driven over one of the trash cans. I'd nearly killed a kid, but I was being arrested because someone else had ruined a garbage can that you can get from Home Depot for $35. I don't recall the officers' names, but I wish I did so I could thank them. Their attitude towards me changed immediately when they saw the condition I was in. One of them took a blanket from the trunk and wrapped it around me. They tried to ask me what had happened, but all I could do was cry. I'm not sure I would have had anything to say anyway. Explaining the bells to someone who had never heard them is like trying to explain the color blue to a dog that's blind from birth. They ushered me into the back of their squad car and took off for the hospital, the one that Fletch and I didn't know about. 12 minutes later, we arrived at Mary Lane Hospital, and I was admitted to the ER. The doctors picked up where the police had left off. What happened? Were you in a car accident? Were you in a fight? But I remained unresponsive. They ran their fingers through my hair, checked me for a concussion, but couldn't find any physical indications, and my pupils responded normally. It's like he's in shock. You don't say. Since I wasn't helping, my clothes had to be cut off of me, just in case there were any injuries that they weren't seeing. The right side of my chest had one gigantic purple bruise. I needed 5 stitches where the splinter had gone into my fingers, and another 2 where it had come out. The rest of my fingers were cleaned and bandaged. Then one of them had the bright idea of giving me something to help me sleep. I wish they hadn't. All I dreamed of was her. Amy Lowell Putnam's corpse, dancing on its post, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth as the bells rang. It was late afternoon. The following day, before I woke up to find my parents staring at me and my wrists handcuffed to the bed. They were looking at me like I was behind glass at an aquarium. A particularly nasty deep-sea fish that turned their stomach. There was pity there too, but mostly disbelief and fear. I wasn't really their little boy anymore. I was a thing, twisted and disturbed, a danger to myself and others. Seeing my parents looking at me like that hurt really bad. But it was still preferable to the blank stare of Amy Lowell's automaton, which was my company at 2 o'clock, and again at 3 and 4. Ryan Dorsett's parents never formally charged me with assault. A civil suit was settled between our families out of court. As a condition to their not pressing charges, I had to seek psychological help. I spent the next 6 months of my life at McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts. It was probably for the best. The first 2 weeks, I didn't say a word to anybody about anything. I can't exactly say why. Shame was certainly a big part of it, and I know that I was afraid that they'd think I was crazy. And then again, given where I was and why, well, the SS Sanity had probably already sailed. After weeks of hearing the bells and watching the automatons reenact their tableaus, after weeks of seeing Amy Lowell Putnam dragged about on her pole, I finally broke down and told them what was happening. A woman I called Dr. Laura was assigned to me. She was in her early 40s, her hair was always messy, and she used a lot of Yiddish expressions. I didn't get most of her jokes, but they still made me feel like she was sharing something, and that I could trust her. She diagnosed me as bipolar, believing my attack on Ryan, my experience hearing the bells, and my belief that I'd visited a haunted clock tower in the middle of a reservoir most likely stemmed from what she called a mixed episode. A state where symptoms of depression and mania often occur simultaneously and auditory hallucinations aren't uncommon. Her theory was horseshit. But there was no way to argue with a psychologist without sounding like one of those guys in the old horror movies screaming, "I'm not mad! I'm not mad!" of an orderly crams them into a straitjacket. You just say, "Oh wow, yeah, that sounds about right." You take whatever pill they give you. You can't win, but you can lose less badly. And I have to admit that after they began injecting me with Haldol, I stopped hearing the bells every hour. She may not have believed my story, but Dr. Laura taught me a lot. We would look at the decisions I regretted, and examine not only the effects of those decisions, but everything that led up to them. What was I doing? How was I feeling? We'd list it all from my emotions to my bodily sensations and try to find the pattern that led to my worst decisions. She helped me isolate my self-destructive triggers. Then we'd discuss how I could continue on in life and accomplish my goals without stumbling blindly into those triggers. After I got out of McLean, we thought it was best that I didn't go back to my high school. My mother bought the state-approved curriculum for homeschooling, and I spent the rest of my high school at our kitchen table. We had met with the superintendent of schools a couple of times. He seemed perfectly happy not to have me in his school system. I can't say that I blame him. I must have seemed like another Robert Keenan waiting to happen. In September of 2000, the week before his 13th birthday, my little brother asked if he could be homeschooled too. In his grade, he had been a fairly popular kid. Then one day, he came home with a bloody nose. 2 weeks later, a black eye, fat lip, a limp. He was being bullied because of me. I remember one day in particular, with perfect clarity, an older boy had knocked him down on the hardwood floor of the gym and dislocated his shoulder. he had to go to the hospital. My dad went ballistic. He directed most of his anger at Mr. Delvino, the principal. He even threatened to sue the school. I got some of it too. He gave me a look that practically screamed, "This is your fault." When he returned home that night, my brother got me alone and asked me a question. "Did you rape Ilena?" At first I was shocked. I thought that I'd misheard him. I mean, I was his brother, and he knew that I loved Ilena. How could he ask me that? "The kids at school, that's what some of them say." After the incident in the yard, Ilena's parents had decided to enroll her at Bishop Gutrin. She hadn't wanted to. I mean, who wants to leave their friends behind senior year, but between Robert Keenan and myself, they just thought that it'd be best for her to get a fresh start. After she left, Sarah Cohen had been very vocal in blaming me. I never held that against Sarah. I figured that I deserved the fallout for what I had done to Robert Dorset, but I hadn't seen this coming. Denials poured out of my mouth. "Yeah, we had sex, but it wasn't..." I couldn't even say it. She never said no, that was true. I never threatened her, so was that. I only wanted to make her feel good. But was that the truth? Like a lot of people, especially guys, I had an image in my mind of what a rapist was, a lone predator, a man in sunglasses and a hooded sweatshirt, hiding in a dimly lit garage with a knife in one hand and an improvised gag in the other. I had an idea that they were a breed apart, depraved, wicked, mean things, aware of the harm and the hurt they can cause, but determined to do it anyway. This was my idea of what a rapist was, and I didn't fit any of my own criteria. Yeah, it was true, I wanted to make Ilena happy, but each time I kissed her, she'd frozen up. That took it as nerves, but I didn't stop. Each time I'd run my hand up her body, she started to cry. I thought it was survivor's guilt, but even if it was, pushing her clearly hadn't made her feel any better, and when I had gotten on top of her and wormed my way beneath her clothes, persisting past stillness and tears, she hadn't said no, but she never said yes. What I had thought, what I had wanted, they didn't matter. Not next to what I did. It's easy to see that now. At the time, I got defensive, unleashed a torrent of vile obscenities about a girl that I'd only moments earlier considered the love of my young life. That night, once everyone was asleep, I made my first of three suicide attempts. Tiptoeing my way into the garage, I took the garden hose off the wall and I pushed one end into the tailpipe of my mom's car. The other end I ran through the driver's side window. The note I left was addressed to Ilena and simply read, "This is your fault." It was pure projection. I got comfortable, I started the engine, and as the car began filling with exhaust, I became dimly aware of a sensation creeping up the back of my neck. Was it the carbon monoxide, or was I being watched? Thump! Had Amy Lowell been the mystery figure people saw inside Rob's car the night he killed himself? Did she collect the souls of those that she'd condemned? Was that how the automaton's face had been burnt? Let her come, I thought. Anything's better than this. But the thump I heard wasn't the sound of Amy Lowell Putnam's post on the garage floor. It was the doorknob slamming into the wall when my brother threw open the door to the house. He saw me and screamed bloody murder until my parents came, and then the three of them could pull me out of the car. The garage was beneath my brother's room, and he had heard the engine start but didn't hear the garage door open, so after a couple of minutes of wondering, he got up to see what was going on. The next thing I knew, I was sitting in the living room with a splitting headache. My mom was hugging me and crying hysterically. It was the first time anyone held me in 9 months. The next morning, I was back in McLenn. Dr. Laura and I spent a lot of time talking about Ilena. I was surprised she was still willing to work with me, knowing what I had done. But she was as patient and kind as ever. After 2 months, I was still struggling to wrap my head around how anyone could think what I had done with Ilena had been wrong. To Ilena. What I had done to Ilena. Why didn't she just say no? It was a textbook example of blaming the victim, but I genuinely didn't understand. I would have stopped. You can never be certain what somebody else is experiencing, and that's why you have to ask and listen and not assume they want exactly what we want. Or that they'll respond exactly like we respond. Understand? I nodded. We weren't in a session, strictly speaking. Dr. Laura probably shouldn't have been talking to me at all. And especially not about something that was at the heart of my treatment. But from time to time, she would. I think she knew I needed the human contact.
Bubba, don't take this as anything but speculation, okay? I can't know what she was thinking any better than you can, but you might want to consider that the last boy that had a crush on her had killed himself 3 months earlier.
I liked it when she called me Bubba. What's that got to do with me?
She might have thought that if she said no, you'd do the same.
Alina, if you're out there and you're reading this, I am sorry. I apologize unreservedly. It was not your fault. I take the full responsibility. If you wanted to press charges against me, I would not refute them. You can get word to me through my parents. If there's anything that you want from me, anything that will bring you the slightest amount of closure is yours. That was stupid. So hurtful. So wrong. I'm sorry. In May of 2003, I received my high school diploma. My parents didn't think I could handle living on my own, but I had to get far away from the spire and the way they looked at me and my reputation around town as I could. My aunt lives in San Jose, California, and I managed to get into a vocational school 20 minutes from her house. Eventually, my parents relented and let me go. Fletch wound up getting into BC, which was a big coup for him. As fate would have it, so did Ilena. From what I understand, the two of them actually wound up becoming pretty close. The last time Fletch and I spoke was November of 2002, right around Thanksgiving. He had stopped hearing the bells before the end of freshman year. Two of Scary Carrie's fingers had to be amputated, along with her thumb. She also lost her left foot from around the mid-calf down. Eventually, she recovered from her aphasia, but not before the school moved her into a special education program. She never made it to college. Mrs. Peterson got her a job at Market Basket bagging groceries. My mom sees her from time to time and usually does her best to avoid her register. Neither Carrie nor her mom have asked about me since the incident. I don't know if she still hears the bells, but I doubt it. As for me, I'm unhappy but alive. I only hear the bells now when I don't take my Zyprexa. But they're never too far from my mind. Someday I'm going to die. And Amy Lowell Putnam is going to claim me. There's nothing I can do to avoid it. A part of me wishes she'd just hurry up and do it already. The bells really do sound so lovely.